You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
We know the answer not only to your energy, but to what makes other stars in the universe shine. Thermonuclear reaction.
And welcome to episode 193 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by James Wilson from Blogging by Cinema Light to discuss a 1966 film that gives us some intense World War I aerial action, starring George Peppard, James Mason, and Ursula Andress, directed by John Guillermin. It's The Blue Max. But first...
The Bell Telephone System brings you another of its series of programs on science. Man's effort to understand...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Welcome to your favorite drive-in theater and a sparkling new season. Watch our screen and local newspapers for all the fine shows coming this way. Show after show will feature the latest hits, the biggest stars for fun-filled, pleasure-packed evenings. Relax, come as you are, and spend an enjoyable night out with the entire family. No parking problems, no babysitting problems. And there are always tasty snacks at our modern refreshment stand.
Thanks, folks. And once again, welcome back.
Hi, folks. I'm Rico.
Oh, Nacho.
He's Peppy.
Si.
You can find us at the concession stand in the lobby.
Along with all sorts of other tasty goodies.
Si.
Rico's Nachos, a refreshingly new and different snack discovery. Chock full of high-quality ingredients, crisp, fresh tortilla chips, covered with creamy aged cheddar cheese, topped off with zesty jalapeno pepper rings. Rico's Nachos, out of sight.
Remember, folks, we're the new star at the snack bar. Rico's Nachos, a new taste treat you can't beat.
See?
Rico's Nachos, on sale at the snack bar now.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
comedy
and great music
in CinemaScope. About black cats, broken mirrors, or walking under ladders, because this is your lucky day. Dreamy, delightful Doris Day, taking you on a musical adventure from moonlighted Miami to star-lighted Broadway. Robert Cummings, who knows he has the world in his hands when he holds her in his arms. Phil Silvers, top man in the nation's who's who of comedy, as the crackpot who hits the jackpot for laughter.
Say, how about a little square dance?
Yeah, hey!
All right, so. Must be these boots. I'm used to dancing my bare feet. How's everybody?
This is strictly business, Mr. Carson.
Yes, Miss Williams, strictly business.
Oh, Mr. Carson.
Love you, dear. More than just sincere. And the bluebells of Broadway are ringing.
The bluebells are ringing with a bagpipe beat on Broadway.
I speak to the stars, and I wait for an answer. That's why I wanna sing like an angel and dance, dance like the devil. So, Mr. Leader man, strike up the band. Let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go.
Lucky me, with the lucky star to guide me, and the one I love beside me, light in me. So fancy free. Don't you wish that you could be?
Billy, darling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry I'm late.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not. If you're looking for your nephew, he's next door.
Yes. I realize it now.
As long as you're here, perhaps I can get you that drink.
Yes, do.
I'm afraid I'm out of champagne.
Send whatever you have.
Schnapps.
Horrible. But quite stimulating. So that's you. Cobra.
Cobra?
Yes, that's what Billy calls you.
Has he been talking about me to you?
I asked. He says you're quite deadly. In sort of a quiet way.
He's a romantic.
You're not.
No.
No. Tonight is a family affair. Are you shocked?
No.
You see, my husband is a very civilized man.
Mm?
And we are great friends.
It must be nice to have an understanding friend.
Oh, yes, it is.
Willie must be getting impatient. Shall I announce you?
Please do. Thank you.
Okay, our movie this time is The Blue Max from 1966. And joining me to discuss this film is James Wilson from Blogging by Cinema Light. James, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Well, yeah, it's always great to have you back. You've been on a few times in the past. I know last time we talked about the Valley of Guanji. We have no dinosaurs this time around, but we have airplane battles, so that should be pretty good. But before we get to this movie, why don't you take a moment, tell everybody a bit about yourself and what you do over there on your site.
Blogging by Cinema Light is just basically a hobby project that people seem to be gravitating towards, and there's no rhyme or reason to it, Todd. Whatever I'm thinking about, I write down. I try and do something every day except Mondays because, you know, things are closed on Mondays. And we'll do, there are some constants. Every Sunday I will break down a particular scene from a film. It can be anything, you know, as long as I've seen it and have, you know, some sort of access to the script or something like that. Saturdays, although it's not a strict rule, we do Take Out the Trash Day, where, you know, I'll post a review for a movie I'm not enthusiastic about. And then Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, it's catch as catch can. Whatever I can grab, go see in the cinema, you know, finish one of the many draft reviews that I've got in the hopper, it just goes up. And at some point, the big project I'm working on this year is I'm doing an index. So I'm going through and, you know, linking all of the things I've done. And I was trying to get it done by my birthday in July, but I'm getting down to the very beginnings of the blog, and I'm reading what I wrote, and I go, boy, there's a lot of mistakes here. And gosh, that link is dead. And so, you know, I can't help myself. I go in and I fix things. So it's taking a little longer, but by the end of the year, I should have it done.
That's a scary thing, isn't it? When you go back, you know, after years and years of blogging and look at the stuff that you wrote way back when, you know, I admit I'm nervous sometimes to look at the older reviews I've written, because I'm going, you know, sometimes I read them, I go, what was I thinking? Or, you know, I've heard other people talk about this movie since then and they all loved it. Why didn't I love it? You know, or, you know, stuff like that.
Usually I'm pretty consistent, but you know, as I get older, I get more tolerant. So sometimes I'll take a look at something that I just slammed and I'll go, ooh, that bad. But you know, I don't change it.
Well, I think it's perfectly fine to reassess things. Yeah, I'm not saying go back and change your old reviews, but I mean, there's definitely been movies where I've watched it and it didn't gel with me, and then, you know, I might revisit it and something clicked. I mean, heck, that even happened a few weeks ago for an episode of this show. I said it right on the podcast. We were talking about the W.C. Fields film, The Man on the Flying Trapeze, and the first time I watched it, I was like, huh? And then I was like, well, heck, this movie's only like an hour and 5 minutes long. Let's watch it again. And the second time, it clicked, you know, so yeah. I don't know.
Well, you know, and people are going to have that same reaction as they go along. I mean, I had that exact same feeling when I was watching the Barbie movie, because I was looking at all these kids coming to see the movie, and they say, and I'm just going to they're just, it's a lot of it's just going to go over their heads. Mm-hmm. But as they get older, they're going to go, oh. I also have that same reaction to every Stanley Kubrick film.
Well, that one I get.
I look at it the first time and I go, what was this? And then, you know, I'm walking down the street and I go, oh, it's right there.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that might be what he intended, you know? He wants you to go back.
It took him years to do it. So, you know, talk about overthinking. So he's always about, he was a chess player, so he's always about six steps ahead of you.
Right.
When
yeah.
you just come to it new. So it's like.
At the same time, I don't know that I would go as far as like that documentary that was out. I'm trying to remember what's it called. Room 2.
Oh, gosh. Three, no. Yeah. The one about The Shining.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that, I watched that movie and I was going, all right, some of this is interesting. Some of this may have some merit, but a lot of these folks need to get a life, you know?
Yes. Just... Yes. I'm writing a review of Summer of 42, and that's actually featured in The Shining. And I'm sure there are college film students who are writing a thesis on the meanings of Summer of 42 in relation to the Shining. And the fact of the matter was The Shining was a Warner Brothers movie. Summer of 42 was a Warner Brothers movie. Mm-hmm. And Stanley liked it a lot. the old sentimental softy. So probably because, you know, it reminded him of growing up in the 40s in on the East Coast. So, you know, there's nothing deeper than that. He liked the movie. He didn't have to spend a lot of money for it.
No, that always comes in handy, too. Yeah. Well, but before we get on to the movie we're talking about today, you mentioned the Barbie movie a moment ago. And I know, you know, you said your site kind of has no rhyme or reason. You know, one post you'll be talking about something old, the next it's your latest visit to the theater. So I know you've been to the theater a lot this summer. I have a lot as well, much more than most years. I finally was like, all right, I'm going to buy the pass and I'm going to go to the movies this summer. Yeah. And I've been doing that. And I saw Barbie. We mentioned as we were getting ready to record, I'm going to see Oppenheimer tomorrow. But I guess as a avid moviegoer, as someone who's seen a bunch of things this summer, what's your take on the summer so far? Because as I was going into it, I was like, well, this is the first summer in a long time that feels like a real summer. You know, yeah. Because with all the COVID stuff recent years, it just felt like kind of half-hearted. And here they're rolling out lots of stuff, and there's always something new to see each weekend. So how's it been going from your point of view?
I think it's great. I like the fact that the sequel films are not doing well and that truly original films are doing blockbuster business. I think that's terrific, and I think it bodes really well. It might get us out of some of the creative slump that we're doing where we just have sequel after sequel with diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that Barbie is wholly original and Oppenheimer is just an extraordinary... Well, I'm not going to spoil anything. I'm going to tell you what I think of Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
But just the fact that it is... you know, it is a study in serious filmmaking about a serious topic. And it's just nice that these wholly original films are the ones that have, you know, lit a fire under people to go back to the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great. I mean, that's if it's a trend, I'll take it. And I enjoyed The Flash. I did not enjoy Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny until the last half hour. And Mission Impossible for me was, you know, I'm going to forget that one as much as I've forgotten the last four. So, you know, it's nice to see something brand new and where the actors aren't looking older than the last time you saw them. Although
except Tom Cruise, right? Yeah.
Younger, you know?
Yeah.
Criminy.
No, I mean, I've been having a lot of fun going to the movies this summer, too. And yeah, I'm I hope it keeps up. I hope that, you know, current things that are going on with the stopping of work doesn't have a negative effect as well. So we shall see. But,
well, you know, with special effects, it takes so long in post-production to get these things through the pipeline that I think they're going to be fine. And, you know, just looking at what's coming up in the previews, there's some things I really want to see. So, you know, I'm hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and of course, even if things slow down here in the months to come, there's always tons of old movies to discover or rediscover, which is part of the point of this show. So let's get on
to... That sounds like a segue.
That is. Didn't I plan that? Well, I didn't plan that at all. So, yeah. Now, let's get to this movie here, The Blue Max from 1966. This is directed by John... Gillerman? I don't know how to pronounce his name. I got to admit.
I pronounce it Gillerman.
Gillerman. It works for me. He's a guy that had a long history in the movies, directed lots of films over a 30-plus year career. You know, everything from doing a couple of Tarzan movies.
Yes.
He did Waltz of the Torridors with Peter Sellers, the 1978 version of Death on the Nile. He did that one.
Yes.
But, of course, the big ones on his filmography, The Towering Inferno from 1974, and, of course, the remake of King Kong coming 2 years later in 1976. And, of course, King Kong Lives 10 years later, but, you know, we don't talk about that much. So, but anyway.
Under our breath, we talk about that.
Yes,
we hide
yes.
that one in the jungle.
And now this film, it's based on a novel that came just like 2 years before the film. So this really seems like a case where it's like the novel came out and they quickly snatched up the rights and work probably started fairly quickly on this because this was a pretty big movie. We'll get into that here in a minute, but I'm going to butcher all the German names here, I'm sure, as we go through this.
I was thinking, you know, this is probably going to take us about, oh, maybe a half an hour longer because of the German names.
Yes. I'll probably just refer to the characters as the, you know, by the actors that played them. But
there you go.
The film focuses on a guy named Bruno Stuchel, something like that.
Stuckel.
Yeah, played by George Papard, who is German by way of Detroit, I guess. But anyway, he's a German soldier in World War I, and he decides that he is going to leave the trenches, which makes sense to me, but you know, he's become a fighter pilot because... you know, it seems a bit more of a prestigious job here. And but it's a bit unusual for him because he's a commoner, whereas the guys that are piloting the planes for the aerial dogfights and all that, they're the wealthy. They're the elite. So he's kind of out of place in that crowd. So Stuckel quickly proves himself to be an effective fighter pilot, but he isn't really driven by wanting to advance the war effort. You know, it's really not about winning the war for him. His main concern is that he wants to shoot down 20 planes so that he can earn the highest honor that he can receive, which is a medal known as the Blue Max. Now, as a matter of fact, he becomes somewhat obsessive about this. In his first mission, he downs a plane, but since there is no witness to this, he doesn't get credit for it. And this angers him big time. So the next time he's out, he actually lures a plane back to his base and then shoots it down so that everybody could witness it. I mean, this is a guy who's really only out for himself. And this kind of rubs everybody the wrong way. However, there's this general, von Klugermann, played by James Mason, who sees potential in Stuckel because he's a commoner. So he can be put to good use in propaganda. You know, he can kind of get the common folks behind the war effort, which is struggling at this time for the Germans. So he decides, well, let's promote this guy. Let's make him out to be a hero. At the same time, this general is spearheading the development of a new monoplane, which Stuckel desperately wants to be the pilot of. Meanwhile, Stuckel also grabs the attention of the general's wife, who is played by Ursula Andress, and the two start a steamy affair. Now, this is a film that is filled with some wild area sequences and some big battle sequences as well. I'm sure we'll get into that as we go through our discussion here. It's very much an epic size production, and it's got some big names attached to it, including cinematographer Douglas Slocum and composer Jerry Goldsmith. So I'm going to turn it over to James here, let him get us started. Give us a few of your thoughts on The Blue Max.
First time I saw it, it had to have been on video, because I do remember when it came out to the local theater and it was rated M and I was too young to see it for a lot of reasons. And so this was kind of on my list of, oh, I missed it in the theater. I'd really like to see it, but I never saw it until after I'd heard the score. And the score is really well renowned in film music circles. And so as part of seeing, you know, what's attached to the music, I sought out the movie, and it's 2.5 hours long. It's probably, I'd say maybe 15 minutes too long.
Yeah,
the aerials, yeah. The highlight of the movie, of course, is the aerial sequences, which are just amazing. It is not, you know, I've read where there are lots of complaints where people say it's not really period accurate and they don't have the proper planes. And I think anybody will, you know, one thing you will notice as you watch the film and the aerial dogfights is they've got these the Germans have these twin machine guns mounted on the plane, and they're firing, but there's no bullet belt feeding those guns. And they kind of, you know, one of the advisors looked at it and said, where are the gun belts? And they said, people won't care. They'll just see the flashes and they'll know the guns are firing, and that's all, you know. So be that as it may, be that that the planes aren't the right type, and you know that there are things. The aerial sequences are just spectacular. Where things kind of get a little problematic is when things are on the ground, because you've got a protagonist, Bruno Stachel, who would look very good in his uniform if he didn't have such a gigantic chip on his shoulder. And he comes from, like you said, a commoner background. And everybody in his flight squad never lets him forget it. And he's constantly trying to prove himself. And his attitude is either stuck-up pride or cavalier glibness. Mm-hmm. And it makes the character kind of unpleasant. You know, he's just a jerk. This is a G-rated podcast, so I'm using the word jerk. George Peppard does everything very well. I mean, he looks Aryan enough for this. But when he's, you know, when he's being proud and circumspect about his background, he's a little too much of that. And when he's being glib, he's just a little too goofy. Mm. So a little too light. So he's kind of problematic throughout the other thing. Fortunately, the rest of the cast is extraordinarily good. James Mason is wonderful throughout this, in a very he's a wonderful propaganda minister, because he's just positive about everything. Ursula Andress is in full cougar mode here, and she's great. And then you've got the 20th century cast of German actors who seem to appear in every 20th Century Fox war movie, because I don't know, Daryl F. Zanuck met them in Europe or something, and that's Jeremy Kemp and Carl Michael Vogler and Anton Differing. Jeremy Kemp is British, but he will always be German to me.
I was going to say, I mean, I don't know how many people in the cast are actually German. I mean, if nobody's really making an attempt at the German accent, I mean, the one who's pulling it off most is the one who has the most right to, and that's Ursula Andress. I mean, the rest of them are, you know, you detect a lot of Brits in there. And they're not trying to disguise their British accents. You know, they're not going for German. It's very much, you know, it feels like we got whoever we could get. And if they had an accent, that's okay. You know, it'll all come out in the wash or whatever. I mean, Papard isn't trying at all. George Papard is George Papard, just the way that he always is. And I mean, he looks more American than anything here, you know, so.
Yes. And but Carl Michael Vogler kind of made a career of playing Nazis. he plays the squad leader who, you know, doesn't think much of, well, that's not saying much because nobody thinks much of Papard in this movie. Stachel in this movie, I should say. And he has Vogler's character is Hauptmann Otto Ritter von Heidemann.
Oh, excellent. Very good. Well done.
Thank you. I took German in high school. So, and his attitude is that war is hell, yes, but he also has the old guard chivalrous way of fighting. You know, you respect your enemy, you play by the rules, but you're still trying to win the war. You are a gentleman as you are a soldier. So there are certain rules of conduct that you do. You do not shoot people in the back. You do not, you play by the rules. It's a little naive when you're talking about war, but, he's a throwback to a time when the soldier was an upper class person of the gentry.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like they see themselves as like the knights in shining armor type of scenario, you know.
That's a really good metaphor. And Stachel, Bruno, let's just call him Bruno because Stachel will sound like we've got colds throughout the entire podcast. Bruno is just, he doesn't have any rules. He is in it for himself, and he wants to obtain his rank. He wants his kills. He wants that medal, and that's kind of his only goal, is to bury his past as a commoner by achieving ranks through what he does in battle. And he doesn't care about the rules. There are a couple of instances where he does do something that is questionable, but, you know, in one circumstance, and it's that one instance you're talking about where, you know, after his first kill doesn't get recorded, you know, because they're stamping how many planes you've shot down in order to get that Blue Max. He goes out on a flight and finds an air reconnaissance plane and shoots the gunner.
Yeah.
And
it's not even a fighter plane, really. I mean,
it's a reconnaissance.
Yeah.
And it's a two-man thing. There's a guy with a machine gun. So, of course, you're going to get him first because, you know, you don't want to be taken out either. And then he motions to the pilot that, no, I'm not going to shoot you down. I'm going to take you back to the airbase because I want this counted. And then right before as everybody sees that he's bringing this British air reconnaissance plane back, everybody sees that that's happening. But the gunner was knocked out and he starts going for his gun again and Bruno shoots him. And takes out the pilot as well, and the plane ends up crashing. Well, everybody looks at that and goes, "You jerk! You lured him back to the airbase, and then you shot them down. you know, just because you wanted to get that little tick mark on your record. And, you know, it's not true at all. The gunner was going for his gun. He could have taken out people on the ground. He could have taken out, you know, Bruno's wingman. He could have taken out Bruno. He was legit in doing that. And, you know, but nobody can confirm the story. So, you know, that's another mark against him. And it's just, you know, he's always trying to climb the ladder and getting pushed a couple of rungs down. Up the ladder, another couple of rungs down. Because he has to prove himself more because he's a commoner. And
he doesn't help his case at all either, because, I mean, ultimately, when that whole incident happens and he's back on the ground and all his fellow pilots and commanders and such are responding to it, his response to the whole situation is quite childish, you know, and yeah. You know, he doesn't do anything to, you know, in any way, you know, make his case for why he had to do this. He kind of just says, well, if you're going to think I'm a scumbag, then I'm going to be a scumbag.
Yeah. I mean, he kind of buys his own press. If you're going to think I'm this way, I'm just going to double down. And, you know, he is, of course, naturally competitive because he's just got that chip on his shoulder and he's very proud, more proud than the other ones, I would say. And it makes him, you know, just challenge and, you know, take on the other people, you know, to the point where he's stealing mistresses and things like this.
Yeah.
So he's just a reprehensible person, and it had to have been a tough role to play.
Well, and, yeah. I mean, you say he's a reprehensible person. I would say that pretty much nobody in this movie really stands out as being a good person. I mean, he's kind of the most, you know, the central figure in a cast of people that I wouldn't want as a part of my life at all, you know?
And yeah.
And I mean, it's already a tricky situation in given that this is another World War One story told from the point of view, at least for us, you know, as Americans, the point of view of the enemy, you know. I mean, of course, you think about the most famous example being All Quiet on the Western Front. I mean, right. Very different type of approach here. But, you know, I found it interesting that here we have another World War One story and it's being told from the enemy's point of view.
Yeah, and part of that is maybe just because war stories are universal.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's in the trenches, and nobody's having a good time except for the generals, and that's a constant. And, you know, if you can see something from the perspective of the enemy, well, then there's the understanding that you don't have in the war situation in the first place. There is that aspect of war is only allowed because it's kind of a vainglorious thing. And if we really didn't want our sons and daughters to go to war, then we wouldn't let our elderly politicians put us into these situations. Oh, I'm getting so political right now.
That's okay.
I'm still fighting World War One. Yeah, it's problematic, but on the other hand, it's also universal. I mean, I'm sure you can find a similar situation on our side as well, where I got to get that Purple Heart.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, one interesting thing you said there was about, you know, the idea that war isn't fun for anybody except for the generals or whatever. Though I do think that in this film, you do kind of get an interesting contrast between the soldiers that are fighting in the trenches and those that are in the air. And you do almost kind of get the impression like that these elites, these wealthy people that are the ones that are being the pilots, that, you know, I'm not saying there's no danger involved, but that it's maybe a cushier gig than being in the trenches, you know, and, you know, they're flying
especially
their missions.
During World War One, I mean, you know, they're firing rifles at planes.
Right. You know? Right. And they're like, you know, they do their missions and such, And then they're going to these fancy parties and, you know, it's all the very high society type of thing. And,
A lot of champagne in this movie.
Lots of champagne, lots of fancy outfits, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think that when you look at those scenes, and then you do have some really dramatic scenes that go on just the ground warfare as well. Yeah, you almost get the sense that, like, for these elites that are the pilots and such, that, you know, this is almost entertainment for them. You know, yes, there's a risk involved, but... You know, they're not really seeing that they're in any real danger. They get to watch it all from the skies and shoot down a few enemy planes.
Right. The one decent thing that Bruno does in the movie is that when he's being driven to the airbase, he takes one swig of his bottle of wine and corks it and throws it to the trench warfare guys for them to share. And the driver looks at him and says, "That was a full bottle." And he says, "Yeah." Then it's all downhill as far as his behavior.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit more about the battle sequences. I mean, you hit on the aerial sequences. I want to talk about those. I thought they were spectacular as well. But also the ground battle stuff I was really impressed by. But yeah, the aerial sequences... It was interesting because, again, just a few weeks back, you know, we did a podcast, an episode of this show on another movie with a lot of great aerial sequences, The Great Waldo Pepper with Robert Redford, which just had some amazing stuff going on there. It's not the same type of thing because that, you know, they're dealing with almost like circus type stuff. You got the wing walking and whatnot. This is battle sequences. And I was really impressed with the way that the planes are swooping around and you know, just the different angles we get. And there's really, you know, just I don't know, it's unlike any other film I think I've seen when it comes to that sort of thing. And I was especially impressed. I mean, there's some great close-up shots and such, but some of the wider shots where you have just dozens of planes swooping around, and it looks like chaos. You know, it looks like they're going to hit each other, you know, or something like that.
Under the main title, there's a major battle, and it's being obscured by everybody's big names. And you're watching the battle, and you're going, "Oh my gosh, this is complicated."
Yeah,
and you know, it's but you know you got to see the 12-point type rather than the stuff going on in the background. It's really, really complicated. That stuff's really hard to do because the cameraman's up in the air too. You got to get everybody lined up. Everybody's got to be in radio contact and look like they're not in radio contact because they're World War One fighters. And just the formations are just amazing, and how they peel off so perfectly. One of the things that I love about the Blue Max, I think this is John Gillerman's best directing in a movie, because some of the camera movements in this, and it doesn't matter whether it's in the air or on the ground, some of his swooping camera movements to take in the flights of the planes are just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And just keeping everything in focus and in shot. I mean, there's, you know, I'm still amazed at the last sequence of the film where they are panning across a crowd that's in the lower background, somehow keeping them in focus and keeping the plane right in the center of the screen and in focus as well.
Yeah.
And it's just a brilliantly directed and tough shot to pull off.
The camera is like at knee level for the people, and it's pointing up, and you're seeing these different figures there in the foreground, and the camera is moving around. I mean, the whole shot has to move in almost like a complete circle around this crowd. And yeah, keeps the plane right there the whole time. It was an amazing shot.
Phenomenal. And it looks beautiful, and it's exciting as well, because it's those cameras are moving at a big clip, really fast. But, you know, it's that way throughout the entire movie, because I was looking at the first shot, and the first shot is just of a battlefield, and it's still, and then the camera pans over to the left, and you start to see figures crossing the field, and then the camera starts moving with them and, you know, eventually collides with them, intersects with them. But I thought, even that's a tough move.
Oh, yeah.
Cat.
Well, I mean, you're making a great transition here to the ground battle sequences, which I think are just as spectacular as the aerial stuff. I was so impressed with just the level of detail going on there. And I mean, I'm no expert on World War One, you know, if you know what we're seeing is accurate, what have you. But just the depth of the action that's going on there, you know, like you said, you got the camera moving along with soldiers as they're crawling out of the trenches and advancing. I mean, if you look at these shots, there's stuff going on at mid-level, all the way further back. I mean, you can see these tiny figures way back on hills that are doing things. And I'm going, oh my gosh, look at the size of this sequence. And then the way the camera's moving through it. At one point I said, oh, well, look what the makers of 1917 made. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And like I said, I've seen a bunch of Gilliman films, but I've never seen him be so creative with the camera moves and give so much verve to the picture from what he's doing. You know, certainly not in Towering Inferno, except for there's one sequence in that, and that's the main title when they're following the helicopter going into San Francisco. That's where, you know, and then it's all downhill from there. But this movie just surges all the way through. And even in love scenes, it's like the camera tilts to keep everybody, you know, on a level in the frame when, you know, she's on the couch and he's, you know, kneeling down next to her and he's a little bit higher, and the camera just sort of tilts to get him on equal footing. It just really complicated stuff. And some of the lighting is just amazing. Slocum just did an amazing job, especially with a lot of those. It seems like none of those shots of the ground combat happened on a clear day.
Yeah, no.
It's always these really darkening, lowering clouds that are really oppressive. It's an amazing looking movie. I think that's due to Slocum and Gillerman and the aerial team that went up and shot all this stuff. Amazing things. Yeah. You know, and so say what you will about the story, the movie itself is, you know, the best possible version of this movie you can have as far as technically.
Oh, yeah.
I'm always blown away by it when I see it again, because there's always something new that I see and said, oh my God, isn't it interesting they did that?
I think this is a movie that, well, I mean, you kind of hinted at it earlier, that we've got elements here like these battle sequences, these aerial sequences and such, that really outshine, you know, other elements of the film. You know, the actual story, you know, some of the execution of that is not necessarily as exciting. It's a little dry. You know, the way that the battle stuff is executed, it's great. It's spectacular. You know, like I was saying before, I mean, if you look at a movie like 1917, I think clearly you can see where this movie, you know, inspired things like that. I'm actually glad, though, that a few moments ago you mentioned the love scenes, because if there's any part of the more talky parts of the film that worked for me, it was actually the love scenes. You know, I don't know what it was there, because I don't know that I can say that Papard and Ursula Andress have chemistry.
They don't have chemistry.
There's always going to be a bit of steam just because that's Ursula Andress. Okay.
Yeah.
But I still thought there was something really intriguing that drew me into, you know, those scenes where, you know, if you want to call it a love scene or whatever, especially the first scene where she comes into his bedroom thinking it's her nephew's bedroom, who she was having an affair with first. He's a, you know, one of the other pilots and such.
Nephew by marriage.
Nephew by marriage. Yes, we should say. But there is this wonderful back and forth between Popard and Ursula Andress that, I don't know, maybe even benefits somewhat by the fact that they don't really have chemistry with each other.
Yeah, it's kind of like they're toying with each other. Mm-hmm. And this is as animated as I've ever seen Ursula Andress get. I mean, she's pretty stoic in a Norway kind of way. Doesn't really do much, but in this, she is all sorts of ranges of emotions and has that smile that's almost animalistic. And it's funny to see her like that because it's interesting because the character is so perverse.
Yeah.
And she, you know, she's just going along for the ride. And her downfall, of course, is that she loses that at the end. Mm. And she starts to take something seriously. And, you know, that's where all the stories fall. But she's really good. And it's really interesting how, you know, for 1966, there's a lot of nudity in this movie. And a lot of suggestiveness that will still get you by with a PG rating. It's like the whole sequence in the after the rainstorm, where basically she's just wearing a towel.
Uh-huh.
It's, and you can't help but watch and go, so close there. So close.
The movie definitely tests the limits of what you could get away with in 1966. And even in the battle sequences, too. We didn't really mention, but it does get... Yeah. For 1966, it gets fairly graphic in the battle
scene. And, you know, even back then, I can't really say that, but because we did have Paths of Glory, which took you into the really bad muck of the Western Front. But this does this extraordinarily effectively. I mean, you know, it not a place you want to be.
Yeah. Well, before we head for the break here, you kind of started to hint at elements of the ending there a moment ago. Let's talk about the ending. I guess this is big spoiler territory, folks. If you don't want to know, maybe skip ahead a few moments. But, you know, I guess just your opinions on how things kind of play out in the ending. I'll just kind of say here, you know, we have the different elements all kind of coming together where Bruno has gotten his medal. And, you know, is the hero and all that, but some problems arise because of questions about the legitimacy of some of his claims about how many planes he shot down. And this is actually, this starts to come to light because of Ursula Andress's character, who he's having an affair with, bringing it out. At the same time, we've got the whole monoplane coming out and being tested and all that. And James Mason's character trying to avoid an embarrassment for the military, and I guess the personal embarrassment of the fact that his wife was having an affair with this guy, puts Popard behind the controls of what has been deemed a death trap, this monoplane, and we get a fiery conclusion. So I guess, what do you think of this ending here, James?
I think it's entirely appropriate. The novel that it's based on, Bruno survives and has a couple of more novels after that and gets worse and worse.
Oh, wow.
So I'm all for this ending because
he gets what's coming to him.
He gets what's coming to him, and still in a way that makes you feel some sort of empathy for his character, because you look at this movie once that plays out as an entire trap. And it's something that he just will not escape, whether it's from prejudice or from the higher ups. Even when he's useful for their purposes, they'll still cut him off at the knees if he's not useful to them because he's just another cog. He's just another piece of cannon fodder. Mm-hmm. And to save the cause embarrassment, they'll take him out.
Yeah. Because, and he still ends up dying a hero, too.
Yeah. Which is, you know, one more perversity to the entire story is that they get their cake and kill it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, it extraordinarily cynical film. But then I can't think of any good war movie that isn't cynical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I thought this was, all in all, a really interesting film as far as portraying World War One. You know, I've certainly seen other World War One films before, but I guess coming at this time, you know, being made in the 60s, you know, I thought this was an interesting new take on things. I think even if you struggle with, you know, the actual talky-talky parts of the movie, let's put it that way. I mean, I suppose you could certainly say there's almost a soap opera quality to those elements of the film. And I can get where some people wouldn't have patience for it. But I think that for the battle sequences, for the aerial sequences of the film, those far outshine the rest of it. And you're missing something if you don't get to see those. I think those alone are worth checking out this film.
But, you know, it kind of has to be, because when you look at movies like Wings and Dawn Patrol and other things like that, those aerial sequences are the highlights of those movies.
Sure.
I mean, they go right, and Grey Waldo Pepper too. Those are the highlights. Those are the things that you go to a theater to see because they're spectacular. And the way everything lines up and how they do everything, the thing I kept thinking about was this must have taken at least a week to set up in order to get this shot, you know, to have the ground troops being attacked by the planes and then having the planes be at the exact moment they have to be in order for the explosions and things to really look like it's coming from the planes. That stuff is tough. I remember this is way far afield, but it was something the Coen brothers were saying when they had done the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Mm-hmm. They said there's one story about a wagon train, and they said, if we'd known how tough it is to get a bunch of cows and wagons in a line, we'd never have done this. And it's true. And the stuff comes at you so fast. It was produced by an editor, Elmo Williams, and he did a lot of things for Fox. And there is that quality to that. This thing is also edited right down to the nanosecond to be as effective as possible. Really nicely done. And I got to talk about Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh, yes. We can't gloss over that. Yeah, you said you were introduced to this film, you know, by the score first, which, you know, normally would be a little bit of a strange thing. But I when you were saying that, I can't argue with it because it's Jerry Goldsmith. I mean, this guy's a master, and this is a great score.
Jerry Goldsmith, this was very early in his career. He'd been doing a bunch of things for radio, and he did a bunch of live TV. Then he started getting into films in the late 50s. And by the time he did this movie, he'd already done two movies for John Huston. He had done Lonely Are the Brave, which is notable because another famous film composer, Bernard Herrmann, was on the set, on the soundstage that day, and heard something that Goldsmith composed for Lonely Are the Brave and said, "You can't use that. It's too good for this movie." and he also did In Harm's Way for Otto Preminger. He was coming up. But this is probably his first road show movie. this was something that had an intermission, and you know, he had done some ancillary stuff for The Agony and the Ecstasy, which he didn't compose, but he did the overture for it. If you've ever seen the full version of that film, and there is an intro to the work of Michelangelo in it, set to this day. And the score for that is absolutely amazing, and nobody's seen it, except you can see it on TCM when they show Agony and the Ecstasy. And this movie is... Goldsmith always did something that I loved. He did not do music for the movie that was on the screen. He did music for the movie that was needed to make this as good as it could be. And for all the cynicism and all the machinations of the characters, the one thing you get in this movie that you understand about George Peppard's character is his love of flying. Mm. Because it just gives you this sense of lifting and freedom. And it's also almost religious, because it's got these bells and gongs in the background as they're flying. You get the majesty of flight,
yeah,
from his score. And nowadays composers compose what's on the screen, and Goldsmith composed for what needed to sell the movie, and he provided that element that was lacking, as opposed to buttressing the stuff that was already there. Mm-hmm. So this was one of his first really big scores. And, you know, he'd go on to do Patton and Chinatown and Star Trek and Alien and lots of other movies that we don't even have the time to go into. But this is his flying movie, because it's just amazing. And one of the wonderful things about it is he was into weird instrumentation. And in this one, he uses part of the orchestration for the music is a wind machine. and he puts it's in the scoring. I saw him perform in Scotland, and they used it when they did the Blue Max. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as I was sitting down to watch the film and seeing the names roll across the opening credits, though, of course, I was distracted by the aerial footage going on behind it. But yes. I did see the name Jerry Goldsmith appear on there, and I was like, oh, well, now I know we're in for something special. You can't go wrong with him.
He has his clunkers. I mean, there are clunkers in his resume. But mostly he just made these things much better than they deserve to be. And, you know, even when the directors didn't agree with him, you listen to what he did and you go, they should have listened. It's like he's adding an element that they just don't see, mm-hmm, because they've lived with it so much. Just an amazing composer. And of course, he's my favorite. So
it's one of the all-time greats. Absolutely. All right. Well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another LAM Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
At Cinema Recall, we want to present to you the finest in film analysis.
Yeah, like action and gore and sex.
We will look at classics by Kubrick, Lynch, Godard, De Palma, and Coppola.
I don't know who the f*** that is, but I'm looking at classic bodies of Christina Hendricks, Keanu Reeves, Salma Hayek, Ryan Reynolds.
We are a serious show for film lovers who enjoy indie foreign films, art house gems, and classic black and white features.
Well, I enjoy big budget blockbusters with great action and sexy people. Maybe our podcast can celebrate all aspects of films, like people who feel like your weird way and like people who feel like my weird way can like get together, man.
They can?
Yeah.
Huh. You know, I like that.
Cinema Recall is available everywhere you find great podcasts. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram under Cinema Recall Podcast and on Twitter at @cinema_recall.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few measly dollars a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of this show, which are no longer available on the main podcast feed. So visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Jim Rex? What's Jim Rex? Would you believe a movie audience guide presented as a public service by this theater's management to help you select your motion picture entertainment? Well, that's what it is. And we urge you to learn these rating symbols and use them as a guide for you and your family. G means suggested for general audiences, all ages. M, suggested for mature audiences, parental discretion advised. R, restricted, persons under 16 not admitted unless accompanied by parent or adult guardian. X, persons under 16 will not be admitted. This seal in advertising indicates that the film was approved under the Motion Picture Code of Self-Regulation.
I love that podcast. I just think it's the best. I learned so much from that podcast. I can't begin to tell you.
Maybe I should put in an ad for my podcast there.
Yeah, that'll well, there okay. You go. See, now you have control.
Yeah. Well, welcome back, everybody. It's time for our recommendations here. This is the part of the show where myself and my guest each get to talk about another movie that we've really enjoyed, something we want everybody to check out for themselves. It might be a forgotten film, might be an old classic, might be something new in the theaters, something new on streaming. It could be anything. So, James, what is your recommendation?
My recommendation is an old film noir from 1949, even though it was made in 1947, and it's called The Window. This is the most wicked, perverse film noir movie I have ever seen. And when I was watching it, I was going, I can't believe they're doing this. It's about, it takes place in the summer in New York City in the sweltering heat. It was actually filmed in New York, but during the winter, which is interesting. And there's a kid, and he's living in the projects, and it's hot, and he can't sleep. So what he decides to do is he opens up his window and goes outside to the fire escape, and he's going to sleep out there. Completely understandable. But then he looks up and he sees some wash hanging, and he sees that there's a breeze hitting the laundry on the line. So he decides to go up a couple of flights on the fire escape and to his upstairs neighbors outside outside their window. And, you know, he gets comfortable, sets up his pillow, and nice breeze, it's all good. And he looks in their window and he sees a murder. And he sees this guy getting stabbed. Evidently the neighbors upstairs regularly roll sailors, and this one got out of hand, and they take the body and they dump it into an abandoned tenement next door, which all of which he sees. And of course he's scared. He goes, runs to mom, who's sleeping, and mom is played by Barbara Hale from the Perry Mason TV show. Mm. And dad, who's played by Kevin McCarthy, works night, so he's not home. Anyway, he tells mom, I just saw somebody kill somebody. And because he is a constant fibber in real life, she just says,
Knock it off. Go back to bed.
It's the boy that cried wolf.
It is literally the boy that cried wolf in a film noir setting. And because he's that way, nobody believes him. Well, his parents don't believe him. They tell him, you shouldn't tell lies. Joey, you shouldn't tell lies, and you shouldn't make things up because it just gets everybody into trouble. So he decides, okay, my parents aren't going to help. I'm going to go to the police. So he goes to the police. They don't believe him either. So there's one thing that happens because he goes to the police. The police go, well, let's see what's going on. And so they go to talk to his parents first, and they say, I can't believe you did that. I can't believe you went to the police and involved the police in this. This is just getting out of control. We're going to get evicted. And then the cop goes upstairs, and he talks to the neighbors, and he poses as an inspector. Everything right in the place, you know, and he's looking around basically to see if there's blood or something or some sort of evidence that there was a murder upstairs, and he can't find anything. But it freaks them out enough to think that somebody knows what's going on. And then the kid becomes the target for them to do away with him. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. Whoever wrote this thing, and it's based on a story by Cornell Woolrich, who was a pretty sick guy, they just form a trap for this kid that you think couldn't get any worse, and it does. I was sitting watching this movie and going, I'm appalled, but I'm loving this.
Well, I looked this up, and it looks really intriguing. And one of the things you didn't mention, I'm like, whoa, the kid is Bobby Driscoll.
Yes.
Walt Disney loaned him out to RKO for this movie.
Yes. And he was like, I don't know how old he was, but he was very, very, very young, and he's really good in it. He just, I mean, he's got this look on it. Of confusion on his face that I had while I was watching the movie.
What?
And this was made in 1947. Disney loaned Driscoll out, and Howard Hughes bought RKO. And Hughes looked at the movie and said, this is unreleasable, and the kid's lousy. So they held on to it for 2 years and then grudgingly released it. And it was their biggest hit of the year. So well, if you really want to see a creepy movie that is really well done, but just borders on child abuse and actually crosses the line, this is the film noir for you. Oh. Because it takes that... that feeling that everybody's against you and that the world is conspiring against you and puts it in the innocent world of a child and makes it that much richer. It's an amazing movie and dirt cheap. They did it all in location, and the kid is absolutely amazing in it. I was just blown away when I saw this movie. I couldn't believe my eyes.
Well, you've hooked me. It sounds really, really intriguing. I'm going to have to see if we can find that streaming anywhere or whatever. So that looks like a trip. So
I saw it on the movies channel on their film noir night, except that it had commercials, and I couldn't wait for the commercials to end.
Those nasty commercials. Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, the film that I'm going to recommend, I decided to recommend another film that features Ursula Andress. So I went with The Tenth Victim from 1965. This is one that I actually happened upon because one night I was trying to decide what to watch. And that's always the hardest thing of every day is figuring out what I'm going to watch because there's so many possibilities. And so I pulled up a list on Letterboxd that was of all of the movies that have been covered on Joe Dante's Trailers from Hell series that they have on YouTube. And so The Tenth Victim, I think, was actually the first film listed because they do it alphabetically. And when you have numbers, they come first. And so The Tenth Victim came first. And so I was like, all right, let's check that out. And I really enjoyed it. It's an Italian film. It's directed by Elio Petri. Stars Marcello Mastroianni and Ursula Andress. And this takes place in the year 2079 after World War III. So, you know, we talked about World War I. Well, here we're beyond World War III now. And this is in a time where wars are no longer a thing because we now have a TV show called The Big Hunt, where contestants from various countries are involved. And in these battles, you know, certain people are designated as hunters and other ones are designated as victims. So you have one person that's out to try and kill another one. And, they, you know, they're going all over the place trying to make this happen. So it actually reminded me a bit of, you know, like other things we've had in more recent times, like, you know, remind me a bit of The Running Man or even something like The Hunger Games.
Yes.
But, you know, just the idea of a game show that is kind of taking the place of wars type of thing. So here we have Ursula Andress is the hunter and Mastroianni is the victim. But at the same time, there's also this budding romance between them. So that complicates things. The movie is clever and playful, and it's got that wonderful futuristic 60s kind of look and feel to it. It's a movie that's just great to look at. I think definitely this had to have been an influence on Mike Myers when he was creating the Austin Powers films. As a matter of fact, I am positive that it was, because I know that as I was watching this, there is this company
that
keeps...
Isn't that where he got the fembots?
Well, I think... I'm trying to remember if there were fembots in it or not, but the one thing I know is in this is that these hunters, they end up having sponsorships, you know, companies that will sponsor them on TV. And so Ursula Andress's character is sponsored by a company called Ming Tea. And in the Austin Powers films, the band that Austin Powers has, you know, they do those little music segments that kind of bridge the gaps between the story. Okay. Susanna Hoffs from the Bangles is in that as well. But anyway, yes, that band, that Austin Powers band, is called Ming Tea after this movie. So anyway, but in general, I mean, this is just kind of a, I don't want to call it campy because it's not really campy. It's just got that cool futuristic 60s feel to it. It's kind of a, I mean, despite the fact that it has to do with a game show where people are out trying to kill each other, it's got this light feel to it. It's just kind of fun. And, of course, you know, Mastroianni and Ursula Andress have great chemistry with each other, or just a lot of fun together. You know, they're great as a pair and they're great as adversaries. So really cool, fun 60s sci-fi flick that, you know, given we were talking about another Ursula Andress movie, I thought I would bring up today.
How's her performance? Is she kind of monosyllabic in this one?
I wouldn't say so. No, I think that she's got, I think being there with Marcello Mastroianni, they bring a lot out of each other. Let's put it that way.
Oh, that's good.
All right. Well, James, I want to thank you for being on the show. If you would please remind everybody of where they can find you and your site.
Oh, just Google Blogging by Cinema Light. You don't need to put any sort of hyphen in Cinema Light. It's just one word. And you will find the blog first thing, and it'll go up to whatever random thing is on at that day. And hope you enjoy it.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that brings us to the end of episode 193 of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. You can find other reviews of Forgotten Films over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook as well. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thank you for listening, and until next time, go watch some old movies. We'll see you again real soon.
Confirmed.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.